Okay. So we're recording.
Well, welcome everybody to the first seminar series of the text. I've just got a handout here to pass around. So today we're going to do a sort of a general introduction to the notion of a text, particularly in terms of what is a sacred text. Many of you may already have a background in this kind of material, I'm not quite sure. So perhaps before we really begin, perhaps we should just briefly go around the table introducing ourselves. I'm Gavin Flood, I'm sort of the convener of this series of seminars. Keo.
I'm the theology student.
I'm Marta. I'm an MST student doing the history of biblical interpretation.
Oh. I'm Gopal Gupta. I'm a D.Phil student in science and Hinduism. I'm Sadhu Paramtapadas. People call me Swami for short. And I'm here to do my MST in the study of religion.
My name is Brad. I'm doing M.Phil in modern theology.
My name is Ernest, and I'm studying theology at St. Stephen's House.
Right. And I am Nasima Chari. Shivadasani visiting the center.
Thank you, thank you. So we have quite a range of different backgrounds are present here, so it make it very interesting, I think. If you have a background in biblical biblical interpretation, some of this will be ABC for you, if you just bear with us for now. You've got two handouts in front of you. One, I'll have to get you one of these. One of these is an outline of what we're going to be doing in the coming weeks. So you have a general account of what the seminar series is about. It's really looking at the notion of a text, which is a fundamental category in our understanding of religions and indeed of culture generally. So it's such a key category that it needs to be sort of critically examined, so that's what we're intending to do in this series of talks or seminars. So we're going to focus on theories of the text over the last 50 years, which have arisen in the human sciences, and particularly looking at the implications of those theories for theology and religious studies, particularly with reference to religious texts. And these developments have broadly occurred within what's become known as the sort of postmodernism or the linguistic turn, and reactions to it, and how we move beyond those intellectual developments of the last 50 years, beyond theory, to coin a term by Terry Eagleton. Now, questions about the nature of text, the nature of reading, and the importance of narrative and signs and symbols are fundamental to any understanding of religion and culture. So that's the premise of this series of seminars, that understanding the category text is fundamental. So it's really intended to provide a kind of preliminary overview to theories of the text within phenomenology, hermeneutics, semiotics, and narratology. And because of the vastness of that, the vast scope of that project, I'm going to encourage you to focus on your own particular fields of interest and to raise questions, bring questions to the seminar from your own backgrounds, if you like. So part of the seminar, I think, is to develop a shared language of discussion over the coming weeks, and to encourage you to raise questions about the text that have arisen in one context and then apply them to a different kind of context. So next week was really the first week of the seminar as such, in which we're going to look at what is a text, and particularly, we're going to look at phenomenological account of sacred text. So we're going to look at intention in the text, the idea of author's intentionality within the text. So I'm going to give a general introduction to phenomenology from Husserl and raise questions about intentionality, bracketing and subjectivity next week. And the suggested reading is E.D. Hirsch, Edward Hirsch's text. It's pretty old now, 67, but it's Validity and Interpretation, in which he's coming from English studies, but he takes Husserl and uses that as a model for a general theory, a general understanding of authorial intention. So I thought we'd begin with Hirsch, because he's fairly important in literary studies, and look at that text as an exemplum of a Husserlian perspective, and then broaden that out in our discussion to the material that we're dealing with in our own work. It's quite a controversial text in a way. Hirsch is responsible for introducing Gadamer, the philosopher Gadamer, into the West, really, through criticizing him. So Hirsch writes this book, Validity and Interpretation, criticizing Gadamer, and then everybody goes and reads Gadamer afterwards as a result of that. So he opens up quite an important area of discussion. Then from phenomenology, we're going to move on to semiotics, the sign in the text. And from intention in the text, we move on to the sign in the text. And there's a fairly difficult reading for that. Read Kristeva's The Semiotic and the Symbolic from her very interesting book, Revolution in Poetic Language. And we then move on to the text in action, social science of the text, and we're going to look at Paul Ricoeur's argument in quite a well-known article called Social Action Considered as a Text. And then moving on from there, the text in the reader. So we looked at the text in action, the sign in the text, the intention in the text, and then we're going to look at the text in the reader, theories of reception. And that's how we're going to end. So it's pretty broad, and we're focusing exclusively on Western theories of the text that have developed in the last 50 years in the history of the Western human sciences. So we're completely ignoring developments in India, and Mimar Psikas and all the rest of it, which are very, very important, which would be deeply interesting to sort of look at in a comparative context. But we'd have to save that for another day. Okay, so that's the cover. That's what we're going to do. And today we're going to have a sort of grand survey, a themes of the text survey, and look at the category text and ask the question, what is a text, and particularly what is a sacred text? I'm going to refer to my notes a bit while I'm doing this. So in our seminar series, Theories of the Text, there are two highly contested categories, a theory and text. So we're going to look at what do we mean by these two categories. So we all have a pre-understanding of what a text is, and many of us will probably take text to mean something like a telephone message when your phone bleeps, or it's become a verb now, to text. But arguably a prototypical text is something like a novel, or a story, or perhaps a poem even. Has anyone done cultural studies here? You probably take text to an advert or a TV program can be a text in that context. So we can look at the parameters of the term text, I thought. And the category text has been of fundamental importance in the development of discourse in the West, and indeed in Indic traditions as well. And I was very surprised to find the term absent from a book by two cultural studies theorists, Len Trisher and McLaughlin. It's a standard work called Critical Terms for Literary Studies, and the term text is absent from there. And either because, I don't know why it is, but it could be because it's so important that it pervades the whole work. So text is a fundamental category that I want to look at today. Secondly, the term theory is also difficult, because we all have a pre-understanding of what theory is. and what that means. Now, part of that pre-understanding probably entails a notion of scientific theories, which are only theories because they're falsifiable. So there's a Popperian idea that a theory is only... You can't prove a theory, but you can only falsify a theory. So... water boils at 100 degrees is a theory which you can falsify. You can't prove it. So it's true as long as it's not falsified. So there's that sense of theory, or there's also a negative sense. I mean, you hear the phrase, oh, it's just a theory, until... or we might have literary theory in mind, which takes on a different kind of understanding of theory. So theory is linked to the idea of explanation and also to understanding. So explanation and understanding. And what is explanation? Well, there are different accounts of explanation, but you could say a fundamental idea of explanation is the location of a cause. To explain something is to locate its cause. So often a theory is the articulation of a cause, the locating a cause. Now, the term can also embrace different kinds of account, which could be alternative descriptions of something. So not only a causal account, but an alternative description. So the sense of theory in this series of seminars is closer to the idea of theory in literary theory than the Popperian scientific understanding of theory as falsifiable explanation. But there are variations between those soft and hard understandings of theory. On the one hand, a theory could be a kind of understanding which entails an alternative explanation, an alternative description. And on the other hand, you've got theory as a falsifiable statement which is aimed at locating a cause. So if they're hard and soft understandings of the term theory, my understanding, for the purpose of these seminars, is more on the softer side than the hard side. Mm. So, today I firstly hope to describe the context of our inquiry into theories of the text, and secondly to raise questions about what is a text, and if we have time, what is a sacred text. Now, for now, I don't want to offer a definition of a text, but simply to assume your pre-understanding of what a text is, and to indicate by it primarily a written document. Ricoeur defines text as a written document, or a text inscribed in language, but I think that's a bit restrictive, because you have oral texts, of course, but for now, just for now, let's stick with this idea of primarily prototypical example of a text as a written document. So a novel is a text, prototypically. And the Bible is a prototypical text, but a poem might not be taken so might not be so prototypical, or a children's playground song is a text as well, but it's not prototypically a text in a sort of popular pre-understanding. Now, all of these have common certain properties, which are the codification of language, and this raises more questions than it solves about the relation of text to work and language to world. So you've got this idea of, do you have a text which represents a work which is independent and can be expressed in different texts, or is work and text so inseparable that you can't separate work out from text? And that's an interesting and important question that we'll be looking at. So you've got In philology, people talk about the witnesses of the text, the text witnesses. So what are they witnesses of? Are they witnesses of a work, which is somehow a disembodied work that exists independently of its articulations? Or can you only ever have particular instantiations of a text? So that's an interesting question that we'll be looking at. Another term that will... Okay, that's on the handout. Okay, what is a text? Another term that we'll be using is hermeneutics, and from hermeneutica, which is to quote Schleiermacher from, quoted in Grondin's book on Gadamer, a methodical exposition of rules governing texts. Schleiermacher was a 19th century theologian who's very important in the development of hermeneutics in the West. Grondin offers the following definition. We take interpretation as referring to what occurs when a really or apparently unfamiliar meaning is made intelligible, when a meaning is made intelligible, not necessarily credible. And hermeneutic theory assumes universal relevance. However, as soon as we become aware that all human behaviour is based... hermeneutic theory assumes universal relevance as soon as we become aware that all human behaviour is based on making sense of things. So it's making sense of things. Now... Oh yeah, I've got that quote there for you. Charles Taylor, another interesting thinker, defines interpretation as follows. Interpretation is an attempt to make clear, to make sense of an object of study. This object must therefore be a text or text analogue, which in some way is confused, incomplete, cloudy, seemingly contradictory in one way or another, unclear. The interpretation aims to bring to light an underlying coherence or sense. These are obvious, really, but it's important to start here, really. So interpretation is an attempt to make clear. And this raises questions about, can you ever get to the true meaning of a text, or is there a true meaning or real meaning, or are there only interpretations? And what are the limits of interpretation? What are the boundaries around interpretation? What are the criteria by which you say that one interpretation is wrong and another is right? Are philological criteria sufficient? Or do you need other kinds of reference points as well? Now, in the history of hermeneutics, you have pre-modern interpretations, modernism, and modern hermeneutics. And today I thought we'd look at some of these developments, looking perhaps briefly at Schleiermacher and Heidegger and Gadamer. Well, this is a grand survey. We're not going to have time to do all this, but we'll see. So you've got pre-modern biblical interpretation, first of all, which I'm going to more or less ignore, but simply to say for now that there's a long history of biblical interpretation. I apologise for this gross oversimplification of ignoring this almost 1,000-year history or whatever. Now, equally as old as the Jewish hermeneutic, we have Indic philosophical traditions, which are arguably primarily hermeneutical, particularly with the Mimamsa. And developed strategies for interpreting sacred scripture. So we're going to ignore that. And following from the Bible's Jewish interpreters, the church fathers also, particularly Origen, always read the text allegorically or symbolically. I don't know if they always did, but that's very important. And then in the medieval period, we have the tradition of holy or spiritual reading, particularly in medieval monastic settings. And this is very well documented by a scholar who was here last year, Mary Carruthers, who had written the Book of Memory and the Craft of Thought, which is about spiritual reading really, in monastic settings. You could say that literal readings of, say, the Bible is fairly recent. Is that
literal meaning?
Yeah, the literalist readings of the Bible are fairly recent.
There was, in the 12th century, there was a big movement among Jewish commentators to just find the literal meaning of the text.
Yeah,
they did a lot of philological work for it.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that's a plain sense, is it? Plain sense of the text, right? Yeah. So anyway, I'm afraid we're going to completely ignore that pre-modern biblical interpretation. Now, with the Reformation, we have the apparent rejection of Catholic interpretations and the idea that Scripture is self-interpreting. And in the 17th century, we find the term hermeneutica being first coined. And there are a number of theories of interpretation linked to the rise of rationalism, whose intention is to discern the true meaning of texts. Now, breaking with the tradition of rationalism, we've got romantic hermeneutics. Now, Kant underlines the importance of subjectivity, or rather subjective cognitive processes in the understanding of the world, which directly influence the turn to the subjective in romanticism. And Kant also made an important distinction between phenomena and things in themselves, and that reason is applicable only to the world of phenomena, and can know nothing of the things in themselves. If this is so, then all inquiry must begin with the interpreting subject, and we have a move away from a purely rational access to the world towards a more... it opens the door for subjective interpretation. This figure, Schleiermacher, sees hermeneutics then as a theory of understanding, and also breaks with a rationalist theory of knowledge and extends the meaning of hermeneutics beyond the understanding of Greek and Latin text to an account of understanding as such. So to understand the world, you have to interpret the world. You get this idea coming in. And he asks, what are the conditions under which understanding can arise at all? What is the basis of human understanding? So for Schleiermacher, understanding is more akin to understanding a friend than an objective scientific thesis. And so we have with Schleiermacher an emphasis on understanding the individual author who produced the work and the linguistic context out of which it arose. No, I don't have this quote now, but it's an interesting quote. Understanding always involves two moments, he says. To understand what is said in the context of the language with its possibilities, and to understand it as a fact in the thinking of the speaker. So you've got the context and the intention, really, of the author. These two hermeneutical tasks are completely equal, and it would be incorrect to label grammatical interpretation the lower and psychological interpretation the higher. So you've got grammatical interpretation and psychological interpretation for Schleiermacher. So you've got grammatical interpretation, which is classical philology and all the rest of it, and psychological interpretation, which is looking at the motives and intentions of the author, authorial intention. And he says both are equal. And he raises the question, can we interpret texts purely by reference to their language or by reference to the author's intention? And does textual meaning reside primarily in one or the other, or in the interaction of both? And that's a fundamental question that will pervade these seminars. Where is the emphasis? Is it in the language of the texts, or is it in authorial intention? To what extent does the text exceed authorial intention? And to what extent are subjective dimensions brought to bear in the reading of text? So a number of questions. Can we get at author's intention? Does author's intention matter? Or is it enough just to have the text and the language of the text, which is independent of the authorial intention? And then to understand the text itself, if you strip out authorial intention and you're left with the text itself and the language of the text, to what extent is your own subjectivity important in understanding the text, or to what extent can your subjectivity be eradicated, or is it desirable to eradicate your subjectivity? So one understanding, one definition of philology is the eradication of subjectivity, as I heard not too long ago. So what extent is that desirable or possible? Okay, moving on then to Schleiermacher's major claims, you've got understanding consists in re-experiencing the mental processes of the author of a text. So, you know, read a novel and you re-experience the authorial intention. You get into the mind of the author. So that's important for him. And he says that hermeneutics is grasping the meaning of the parts through understanding or divining the whole, and understanding the whole through the parts. So you get this hermeneutical circle, what he calls a hermeneutical circle. To understand the whole, you've got to understand the parts, but to understand the parts, you have a pre-understanding of the whole as well. And that hermeneutics then, it perceives, is involves in, through that process, in understanding the individuality of the author and the author's intention. But it also seeks to understand more than the text might explicitly express. Okay, moving on to modern hermeneutics. The problems of modern hermeneutics as I see them are the relation between explanation and understanding, or epistemology and hermeneutics, i.e. the location of a cause and a different kind of understanding, which is a redescription or an accounting of a text in different terms. So hermeneutics seems to resist the epistemological desire for discourse to be commensurable or to be able to subsume it under a set of rules leading to a rational agreement. So you've got, I mean, there's an emphasis of perhaps an agreement in an epistemology, you want to find the truth, but arguably in hermeneutics there's a recognition of difference and less desire to subsume all accounts of a phenomenon under a single heading, as it were, under a single kind of rational agreement. And linked to this also the problem of rationality. Are there objective or universal criteria of rationality whereby you can decide the status of a text or the truth of a text? Although are there purely regional and plural rationalities? That's one problem. And what's the relation between critique and hermeneutics? If critique is a discourse that lays bare the contradictions within a narrative and the socio-historical conditions of narrative, then is critique itself outside of interpretation or not? So on the one hand you've got interpretation, but some say, well, the interpretation isn't enough, you've got to also have critique, a critique which lays bare, say, the contradictions within a text, or which opens up the social conditions under which it arises. So if a text, take a topical example, if a text, say, women have got to wear the veil or something, now, is that and now you can interpret that to mean various things, that you cover your face or you just wear a headscarf. And some have critiqued it, but you can also say, "Ah, no, but it's not enough to interpret it. You have to critique it because it hides a kind of a will to power, a certain kind of discourse of power relations in a particular community." So you could argue that. So the idea that you could argue that hermeneutics is within a tradition, it's tradition specific, and critique as a discourse always comes from outside, and it's very interesting that relation between critique and hermeneutics.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Oh yeah, do interrupt.
What would be like the epistemological explanation of that statement?
Of which statement? The
women should wear the veil.
Oh yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, I don't think you couldn't have one. I don't think it would be. I'm thinking that. actually, no, you could. You could. An example might be, it might be, say, in terms of, you might have to have a theory, a general theory of religion, in which accounted for gender relationships in a particular way,
mm-hmm.
Which would account for women wearing the veil in that way.
And that could be both within and without the tradition.
It could probably be from without the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a sort of an implied critique, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So, say a Marxist understanding of religion, a Marxist explanation of religion, which would say, "Oh, religion isn't what it says. It actually it can be explained by these other factors, economic factors or whatever." You could look at the veining of women in the context of that. There could be a Marxist account of that. That would be an epistemological explanation. It's not a good example, probably. It's just like a sensitive example. Yeah, so I think an epistemological account will always be external. Okay. The next thing then on this bullet point. Oh yeah, if interpretation is constrained by historical prejudice, as many claim, that we can't, that we're always stuck within the context of our histories. How can we step outside of our own history? Can we distinguish between correct and distorted interpretations? And if we say we can, what's the criteria for that? What are your judgments based on? Should I open the window? Are you hot in here? Everyone, or? Okay. Shall I open the window?
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Harvey. Oh, thanks. Another problem. If interpretation cannot appeal to a true reality outside of interpretation, but only establish a coherent picture, as one thinker called Vattimo, the Italian philosopher, says, what are the standards, or the epistemological standards, of criteria for judging between conflicting interpretations? Is there something more than criteria of adequacy that do you only have conflicting interpretations, or can you get at the truth of a text independently of interpretations? There's also the problem of the hermeneutic circle. When something, e.g. part of a text, can only be understood in relation to other things, or the whole of the text, how do you sort of enter into the hermeneutic circle? How do you begin to where do you begin? How do you get in there? And there's also the problem of truth and method, to use Gadamer's phrase. I don't think I'll talk about foundations and multi-foundations in a moment. Okay, now, interpretation then gets developed by a philosopher called Heidegger, and who says that interpretation, not of the text, but of being itself, existence itself, is subject to interpretation. And he talks about various four structures of understanding. That you have a prejudice, that understanding the world, you have to have prejudice, there are certain preconditions. To be a human being, you have to have a kind of prejudice, a certain precondition. Certain four structures of understanding are in place that are necessary for any knowledge or understanding to arise. So an interpretation is grounded in something we grasp in advance, a foreconception. And Gadamer develops this idea and says that our question, by contrast to Heidegger's, is how hermeneutics, once freed from the ontological obstructions of scientific concepts of objectivity, can do justice to the historicity of understanding. So he wants to see hermeneutics as freed from the notion of a scientific falsifiable theory, and to recognise its place within historicity, within history. So for Gadamer, understanding and interpretation always involves a projection into the text. So, quote, a person who is trying to understand a text is always projecting. He projects a meaning for the text as a whole as soon as some initial meaning emerges in the text. So you start to read a text and you get some initial meaning and then you project that meaning into the whole. Again, the initial meaning emerges only because he is reading the text with particular expectations in regard to a certain meaning. Working up this foreconception, which is constantly revised in terms of what emerges as he penetrates into the meaning, is understanding what is there. So we know this from our own experience. We read a text and we have an inkling of what it's about. We project that inkling into the whole of the text. And then that's modified the further you read, the more you read. So meaning is gradually illumined by repeated meaning. So it's kind of obvious, really, but it's a, perhaps an important point to make, that meaning is illumined by repeated readings. And particularly in religious contexts, I mean, liturgical readings of texts are repeated readings of texts over lifetimes. You read the text over and over again, and never... One possibility is that, I mean, some texts have a sort of semantic density, that they always new meanings are broken open from them through repeated meaning. Now, okay, so the point then is that pre-understanding or prejudice is a precondition for any understanding at all. Meaning only occurs because of preconception or prejudice, so it's a Gadamist phrase, prejudice. And pre-understanding constitutes the universal character of hermeneutics, arguably. And for Gadamer, he talks about truth being the understanding through a tradition as opposed to method, which is explanation through objectivist science. So his distinction between truth and method, he thinks hermeneutics is linked to truth because that is revealed through traditions of interpretation, through traditions of understanding. And to be in a tradition of understanding is to be a human being, really, as opposed to objectivist explanations, which is the location of a cause. So culture, bildung, is more important to understanding than method. Now the problem is, on this account, when a text is incomprehensible, there's no way of telling whether the fault is in the reader's foreknowledge, in my pre-understanding, or in the text itself. Assumptions about the text's unity overlooks contradictions within it, which is the deconstructionist critique. The deconstructionist Derrida and so on, so that assuming a text has a unity overlooks the contradictions inherent within text, and the point is not to understand the unity of the text but to break open the text to understand its inherent contradictions. A bit like Nagarjuna in Buddhism tried to do that. Now Gadamer's response is that truth in the text allows us to understand the things. We can't understand the world without understanding the text in a way. So to understand the thing itself is to understand its meaning, which points to a universal ontological structure. And that structure is that the being that can be understood is language. The being that can be understood is language. So being and language are completely intertwined for Gadamer. You can't separate out being from language. No, that's open to question. Okay, so there's that kind of modern hermeneutics, particularly ending up in Gadamer. You then get another kind of tradition, which isn't really hermeneutical, but it's deconstructive. Deconstruction, where you've got in the early 20th century, you had the rise of linguistics, and particularly Ferdinand de Saussure. Do you know of Saussure? You may do, some of you. Yeah. And he wrote a book, Course in General Linguistics. So you've got a sign, which comprises two things, the signifier and what it signifies. And he talked about the arbitrary relationship between the two. So the sign is arbitrarily connected with what it signifies. So, vriksha arbra, baum, tree are all words with the same signified. But it's historical contingency that has led to those particular words referring to those objects. And this idea is developed in the deconstruction of people, French philosophers like Derrida, who says there's no relationship between the signifier and the signified. So in the postmodern world, the signifiers are cut free from their signifieds, and we're kind of floating in a world of signifiers free from their reference, in a sense, floating in an ocean of signifiers free from their reference. And also an important here is the differential network of meaning. So you understand a sign because of what it is not. So the word cat is not dog or table or shoelaces or whatever. So meaning arises because of difference, because of difference because something is different from something else, but also because the meaning, the ultimate end, is always deferred. There's always a deferral. You can never arrive at finality. So he coined this term "difference," which has these two connotations: of difference and to defer. The meaning is always deferred. But a particularly important is the centrality of language. Another important dimension is narrativity. So is narrative imposed on text and even on human life, or is it inherent in human action and flows from it, which relates to text in the sense that texts articulate and express the narrative of human life? And there are different theories of narrative, which I won't go into now because I want to let you talk. So theories of narrative, you've got narrative realism, which is that narrative is inherent in the structure of human life because we're born and we live and we die. In that book, After Virtue, McIntyre rhetorically asks, for those who claim that in life there are no endings, have they never heard of death, he says. he rhetorically asks that. So there's narrative realism. There's also narrative constructivism, which was particularly important about 20 years ago, which says that there's no narrative inherent in life reflected in text, but narratives are purely constructed. So textual life is, as it were, history particularly, is a constructed narrative from human intentions and so on. But there's nothing inherent in life that produces a narrative which can be reflected in a text. And there's a melding of both positions with Paul Ricoeur, particularly in Time and Narrative, which he finished in the late 80s. Now we're still left then with various questions. What is a text and what is a sacred text? If the last 5-10 minutes, if we could look at that question, what is a sacred text, and particularly, I think that might be useful. And how, if at all, are these hermeneutical and deconstructionist concerns relevant to theology or the study of religions? And indeed, is the category text useful in understanding religions? Now, some might claim that theology has more contemporary relevance than religious studies because it, A, embraces post-modern or post-foundational developments in its interest in theories of the text, in contrast to religious studies, which, from the perspective of some theologians, is fundamentally modernist. So that's an important issue. And B, theology allows inquiry or understanding beyond description, whereas religious studies doesn't, on that argument. I don't agree with this, but that's the argument. And C, theology can make claims about the world and human persons, whereas RS is always a third order discourse. And is that justified? So there are questions of method there that we might like to look at. But particularly I'd like to look at this question, what is a sacred text, or what is a text, or what is a sacred text? And that question we'll be looking at really in the coming seminars. But any ideas? What's your pre-understanding of a sacred text? What's a sacred text? If I say the word sacred text, what comes to mind?
Well,
Revered.
Okay, it brings to the dimension of a revelation.
Revelation. A revered text, a revealed text.
Understood to be perfect.
Perfect. What does that mean? It means
sort of without mistakes as
yeah,
far
okay.
as the words itself.
That's very interesting because some of the texts that I look at, these tantric texts, they have lots of mistakes in them. But what's and so the commentators are embarrassed by this. Call it this is divine language. This is these mistakes are actually an indication of their perfection. Quite the opposite.
I wouldn't agree with him because, for example, the Bhagavata Purana.
Yeah.
It states very clearly that this text is composed, might have mistakes in its composition, but the message it gives is perfect. So
okay,
it right. might not be perfect linguistically.
So you've got a perfect message, but an imperfect medium. Okay, that's an interesting idea. Yeah. What else do we think a sacred text is? That's an interesting. I mean, that's an idea. You certainly you get the idea that the pure text is in heaven, as it were, which becomes, but as it falls into the world, it becomes contaminated or corrupted in some sense. You get that idea strongly in Indian traditions. So the medium, because it's in the world, is ipso facto impure or imperfect. But the message is perfect.
Unchanging,
yes. Yeah, unchanging. Sacred text is unchanging.
I would again disagree with that because, for example, the Mahabharata itself claims that when the Mahabharata was first written, it was 8,800 verses. In its second edition, it came to 24,000 verses. In its third edition, it came to 100,000 verses, so it is always changing.
Does that mean it's just getting shorter?
No, it's getting bigger.
Oh, it's getting bigger?
Yeah, but then the essence is the same.
I think it's what he's referring to, unchanging the spirit of the language.
Mm. What do you mean by unchanging? Do you mean the language?
Yeah, but then also there are different types of sacred texts.
Yeah.
It isn't necessary that the...
Yeah, absolutely. You can't generalize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Different types, that's right.
For example, in the Ishavasya Upanishad, depending upon the recension of the Shukla Yajurveda, in one, the Kanva recension, there are 18 mantras. In the Madhyandana recension, there are only 17 mantras.
Right.
One mantra is missing in it.
Right.
So, the transmission of the text itself, there was a change.
So how does the tradition, what does the tradition say? The tradition say that the extra mantra was an addition, or was a later addition, or was it lost?
They won't say anything about
it. I see, yeah.
I follow this tradition. For me, there are 18 mantras. For him, there are missing.
I see. Yeah.
Likewise, the Bhagavad Gita also, we believe there are 700 verses, but a modern scholar by the name Yadav Vyasa, he's from Andhra Pradesh, has discovered a few more verses, and the text now, according to me, is 730 verses.
Right. So
where have these extra verses come from?
Mm.
So it's possible, even the sacred text in the revealed, as we call it. In the Srirangam temple, in a stone inscription, one extra verse is found, as it is in Tamil it is said,
right.
as it is stated in the Bhagavad Gita.
Right. So you've got variability then?
Yeah.
So
we don't have it in the printed versions, in the inscription statements.
So on the other hand, we've got historical contingency that these texts are subject to change, and we know that from different traditions. So in one tradition you've got 18 mantras, another 17, and then you've got an extra verse on the stone inscription and so on. So there's great variability. And yet traditions themselves, how do you square that claim, the historicity of texts, with the tradition-specific claim that texts are, you know, revealed, perfected, and so on. So there's a tension in tradition's understanding of them. And also, I mean, like, is the Quran is a revealed text, clearly revealed text, but the Bible isn't a revealed text in that sense. You could say that, so the New Testament bears witness to the revelation of Christ, but is not itself revelation. Or if the Bible is revelation, it's revelation to a very different sense to the Quran being revelation, or the Veda being revelation. Perhaps the Veda is closer to the Quran in its revelation than to the Bible.
Well, and there are also different degrees of revelation. I mean, you know,
yeah.
The literal word of God versus, you know, inspiration by the Holy Spirit. I mean, it's still revealed, it's just
right.
Revealed maybe in a less direct way.
Yeah, that's right. So you could have, the literal word of God as opposed to inspired speech kind of thing, In India, you've got the national secondary revelation, which you've got the Veda, which is direct revelation. Then you've got the Smriti text of the tradition, which is kind of secondary revelation, inspired speech. Yeah. Now these are all. There's quite a lot there. These are all understandings of the sacred text from within the tradition. Now, secular readings of sacred texts might claim that actually the sacred text, you can't privilege a sacred text in this way through saying that it's revealed, or you can't revere it in this way. You can't say that it's perfect, or you can't say its message is perfect. Those tradition internal claims have to be disallowed if you're to understand the text in its historical concreteness. So that in cultural studies and literary studies and so on, there's the idea of seeing the Bible as literature, and there's seeing sacred texts purely in terms of on a par with other kinds of texts, not privileging them, not putting them on a pedestal. Are the claims of those different? The tradition internal claims of the text versus the kind of external claims of the text are. Is there a conflict between them? To what degree is there necessarily a conflict between them? And to what degree can you claim that one is superior to the other? Put it crudely. I'm not sure that I want you to answer that, but that's that. Do you see the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's probably ABC, is it? That's obvious. Is there an equality to text? There are some texts. Okay, another one, semantic density. I was asking somebody in Cambridge about text, and they used the phrase semantic density. A sacred text is defined by its semantic density. What does that mean? Presumably it means its richness with regard to interpretation, that you can never get to the bottom of the interpretation of it. So an advert for toothpaste is arguably not semantically dense, whereas the New Testament is semantically dense. But how do you decide on what that is? Another understanding of sacred text, if I might be so bold, is to argue that it is actually always embedded within a ritual sphere.
I was thinking about the same thing.
Yeah. It's always articulated in a ritual sphere. And you could say that it's the a text from the past comes into a present orality in a ritual sphere. It's re-enlivened in the ritual context.
Can it be spiritual instead of ritual?
Well, yeah. What do we mean? Yeah, spiritual text.
Because, you know, rituals deal with the kind of activities and so on.
Mm.
But, you know, the Vedic literature itself is usually a example.
Yeah.
Lots of sacrifices have been described here and there. But they have been condemned in Upanishads.
That's right. So you get a reinterpretation of the ritual, actually.
Yeah.
The internal.
Yeah, ritual doesn't take you anywhere. Rituals are like leaky boats, you know.
Yes.
Then
yes.
They sink somewhere.
Yes.
You see. So Upanishad, the Mundaka Upanishad, for example, clearly denounces the practice of rituals.
So how is the Upanishadic, how are the Upanishadic texts kept alive through the generations? Is it just through recording, or is there any ritual enactment?
Rituals have been completely denounced in the Upanishads.
Yeah, oh yes, indeed, but the actual Upanishadic texts themselves, how are they preserved through the generations? Presumably through being taught.
Yeah, that's right.
By
word of mouth.
By word of mouth and so on.
Guru-Shishya relationship.
Guru-Shishya relationship.
And they were being chanted with swara, like the Vedas themselves. Even the Upanishads. Even Paninian grammar, for example. Paninian aphorisms were once chanted with swara. So that's how it has been transmitted.
Could you extend the notion of ritual to include,
for example,
by ritual?
Yeah, I want to go to heaven.
Yeah.
So the Ayurveda says, perform a ritual called Jyotishtoma, you'll go to heaven.
Yeah.
I want children. Pashuyaga is there.
Yeah.
They want money. Do that.
Yeah.
Karivi Yaga is there to get copious rains. India is badly enough.
Indeed. So it doesn't work.
These rituals,
when
are purely materialistic and spirit, they get you what you want.
Right.
To make your life happy and comfortable. But they can't take you beyond this world.
No. That's what you brought the Upanishads.
That's where the Upanishads step in.
But if you said what the Upanishads are about is about the internalization of the ritual.
Exactly.
You could argue that the internalization of the ritual is itself not outside of ritual, not outside of this category.
Yeah, this is what is called in the late Agama text, like the Atisam that we are going to read.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Antaryaga.
Yeah, Antaryaga, yeah.
So this is better than Bahiryaga, what you do outside.
Yeah. And that Antaryaga, that internalization of the ritual. Is also perhaps the internalization of the text. But ritual in context is arguably important in the transmission of sacred texts, although some sacred texts like the Upanishads dispute the importance of ritual itself articulated in the texts. But you could argue it's a different kind of ritual sphere that they're coming into.
I mean, when you were talking about semantic density before, I was thinking about other kinds of content-oriented qualities that might distinguish sacred texts. For example, the assumption that there's some realm outside the physical, obvious world that is made reference to either implicitly or explicitly, and other things like that.
Right. So the semantic density depends upon some extra textual kind of reference, in a sense. It could do.
It could be within the text as well.
Right.
I mean, you know, if a text is talking about another world, then it's within the text.
Sure.
It can
sure.
be without the text.
So if a text is talking about heaven or something, say T.S. Eliot, the Four Quartets, or Dante, Purgatory, they're not sacred texts, but they nevertheless have qualities of semantic density and perhaps some of these other qualities. Now it's interesting, what is it that distinguishes, say, the Bible? What is it that makes a text sacred as opposed to like something like Dante or T.S. Eliot? It's a very interesting question there. Is it ritual? Is it the enactment in a ritual sphere?
Mm.
Could Alice in Wonderland arguably become a sacred text?
Isn't it like it depending on the reader to some extent?
The reader.
I don't think Christian would consider Veda as sacred in sense,
oh, indeed,
in a sense
indeed.
That
indeed. Good point.
Yeah.
So it's the community of reception
yeah.
that defines the sacred text.
To some extent. At
yeah.
least that should be one element.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a Catholic theologian, David Tracy, who's talked about the notion of the classic, and then a classic, like maybe Dante's Purgatorio is a classic in the sense that it sort of transcends its period. It's not a period piece, you
no.
know, relegated to simple historical study, and yet it's not maybe a sacred classic or a sacred text in that it doesn't demand the reader's ultimate sort of allegiance or dependence. You know, the text is not able to hold a ritual community. It's not able to create a world in which that ritual community can exist,
right.
And thus it's a classic, but maybe not a sacred
right.
classic.
Right. Right. So a classic can't do that, can't maintain a community.
Well, a classic transcends a period,
yeah.
but only a sacred classic can maintain a community,
yeah, that's really
a
important.
Ritual community. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think this is, yeah. So, community of reception, something like that?
Mm.
Yeah. So a text is sacred because a particular community of reception says it's sacred, claims it's sacred. Yeah.
Hmm.
That's very interesting. I think we've arrived at a definition of a sacred text, haven't we? You have. Okay, so what is it that makes a text sacred? We're saying community of reception. It's not just enough, it's not just any old reader, it's not like, it's a community of readers, it's not individual readers that determine the sacrality of a text, but a community. Semantic density, I'll be happy with that as an important dimension of the sacred text. That was Dan Hardy in Oxford, Cambridge, his phrase, semantic density. And we weren't happy with ritual reception, but I quite like that. But community of reception, I'm happy with that. And indeed, many sacred texts are claimed to be revealed, but arguably something like the Bible isn't revealed in the direct sense in which the Quran or the Vedas are said to be revealed. And some texts refute the revelation, of course. Unchanging, that's another one, yeah. That's a kind of tradition-specific understanding. Anyway, we'll have to think about this further, so do think about it. We've got to stop, I'm afraid. Well, thanks everybody for your input there. Next week, I can't get the text to you until Monday, I'm afraid, but you may be able to get hold of Hirsch's book, but I can't have it. I can't have a photocopy for you till Monday because I've left it at home in Cambridge, so I'll have to go and get it over the weekend. So next week we'll be looking at phenomenology, looking at basic understanding of what phenomenology is, and phenomenological Husserlian understanding of text, and raising the question of sacred text that we've talked about this afternoon in relation to phenomenology. Is that right? Anyone coming next week? Have you got some pages?